Today's K Show will be on case 28 in the Wu Mong Kan, the Wu Men Quan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 28 is entitled Ryu Tan Blows Out the Candle. Toku-san asked Ryu Tan about Zen far into the night. At last, Ryu Tan said, "The night is late, why don't you retire?" Toku-san made his bows and lifted the blinds to withdraw, but he was met by darkness. Turning back to Ryutan, he said, "It's dark outside." Ryutan lit a paper candle and handed it to him. Toku-san was about to take it when Ryutan blew it out. At this, all of a sudden, Toku-san went through a deep experience and made vows. Ryutan said, "What sort of realization do you have?" "From now on," said Toku-san, "I will not doubt the words of an old Osho who was renowned everywhere under the sun." The next day, Ryutan ascended the rostrum and said, "I see a fellow among you. His fangs are like the sword tree. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. Strike him with a stick and he won't turn his head to look at you. Somewhere or other, he will climb the highest peaks and establish our way there." Toku-san brought his notes on the Diamond Sutra to the front of the hall, pointed to them with a torch, and said, "Even though you have exhausted the abstruse doctrines, it's like placing a hair in vast space. Even though you have learned all the secrets of the world, it is like a drop of water dripping in the great ocean." And he burned all his notes, then making vows, he took his leave of his teacher. Mulan's comment, before Toku-san crossed the barrier from his native place, his mind burned and his mouth uttered bitterness. He went southward, intending to stamp out the doctrines of special transmission outside the sutras. When he reached the road to Reishu, he asked an old woman to let him have lunch to refresh his mind. "Your worship," the old woman said, "what sort of literature do you carry in your pack?" "Commentaries on the Diamond Sutra," said Toku-san. The old woman said, "I hear it said in the sutra, past mind cannot be held, present mind cannot be held, future mind cannot be held." Now, I would like to ask you, what mind are you going to have refreshed? At this question, Toku-san was dumbfounded. However, he did not remain inert under her words, but asked, "Do you know of any good teacher around here?" The old woman said, 5 miles from here, you will find Ryutan Osho." Coming to Ryutan, Toku-san got the worst of it. His former words were inconsistent with his later ones. As for Ryutan, he seemed to have lost all shame in his compassion towards his son. Finding a bit of live coal in the other enough to start a fire, he hurriedly poured on muddy water to annihilate everything at once. A little cool reflection tells us it was all a farce. Mulan's verse, "Hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name," may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes. So I want to thank everybody for really wonderful sitting this morning. Everybody was sitting very deeply. We have that long sit in the morning, and it's really wonderful to see everybody so deeply immersed in samadhi. So thank you so much for that. So some of you have heard this story many times, and some of you might not be familiar with it. So let me just give you the bare outlines. The koan's a little confusing because Toku-san and Ryutan sound almost the same. So it's like Toku-san and Ryutan and Ryutan and Toku-san. It's like, wait, who's who? So Toku-san was originally named Shu. And he was an expert. He was a monk who was an expert on the Diamond Sutra. And he was a really deep student of the sutra, and he felt that studying the sutras made him wise and fully realized human being. And he was impeccable in his study of the sutras. He knew everything about the Diamond Sutra. He could quote chapter and verse, and he knew the history. He knew more than Red Pine does in his commentary. We've been reading the Diamond Sutra. So he heard that there was a sect of Buddhism called the Chan sect, the Zen sect. And that they said the sutras weren't the path to awakening. You had to look directly at your own mind. And he was so upset by this that he decided that he was going to go to the part of China where Zen had established deep roots. And he was going to encounter the leaders of the Zen sect. And he was going to expose them as the ignoramuses they really were. You know, the phonies and frauds. And so he was on his way. And in those days, people didn't have trains and they didn't have mass transit. If you wanted to go and debate with somebody in Northwest China, you had to put a backpack on, and the backpack would have been a basket in those days. And it would have been full of scrolls, right? He would have taken all his precious scrolls and covered them with waterproof covering. So he's trudging along with his backpack full of scrolls, and he stops at an inn. One night he stops at an inn, and or one afternoon he stops at an inn, and he asks the lady at the inn for a snack. The Chinese word for like a snack or a bit of something to eat, something to nosh on, would be tianxin, which means mind refreshment. So he says, can I have a bit of tianxin, mind refreshment? And she is just a waitress at this inn, but she turns out she's deeply enlightened. She's just people don't know she's enlightened, but she is. And she turns to him and she says, oh, so you want to refresh your mind, do you? Well, the Diamond Sutras, which you claim, and somehow she knows he's the expert on the Diamond Sutra. The Diamond Sutra says, you know, there's no mind in the past, there's no mind in the present, and there's no mind in the future. So what mind are you going to refresh? And the question is like a knife in his heart. He realizes now that he's been studying the Diamond Sutra all these years, but because his study hasn't been illuminated by practice, He really doesn't know much, right? He doesn't know anything, really. It's all theoretical. It's not, he's not fully realized as he thought he was. So he's instead of saying, well, that you're an outrage, who are you, you're just a waitress, he's a good man. And he's cut to the quick by this. It really hurts, it's like a knife. He realizes, my God, you know, I don't know what the healthy suture is all about. So he says to her, well, you obviously know something. Where did you learn this? You know, where did you get this? And she says, you know, there's a Zen community up in the hills, and there's an old monk there named Ryotan, who's the abbot. And basically, he taught me what I know. He showed me the way to my true nature, to fundamental reality. So being a good man, Diamond Shu decides not to go home and not to insult this woman, but to take her advice and go find Ryotan. So when he goes to the temple, he becomes a monk in the temple, and he takes a new ordination name as Tokusan. And so he's studying with Ryotan, the old master. So the sutra scholar is studying with the old master, and he's still kind of a sutra scholar, which is a good thing to be. But when he goes in to see Ryotan, you know, they have these long debates, these long conversations, and they're very abstruse. And the old master is trying to get the sutra scholar to pay attention to the immediate moment, to pay attention to his mind as it's operating in the immediate moment. He wants him to look at his consciousness from moment to moment and not keep resorting to passages from the Diamond Sutra. See, so let's quit talking about the Diamond Sutra. Let's just look at our own experience directly. And this goes on for years. And finally, one night, the Sutra scholar comes in and he talks to the old master, and he talks and they talk, and it's like the Dokusan, it starts in the afternoon, and then, you know, finally Tokusan gets up, the old master gets up, and he looks out the window, and it's dark. It's like, oh my God, we've talked for hours, you know. Boy, all the other people are in the Dokusan line, waiting to get to see the teacher. It's like, oh my God. So anyway, it's dark. He says, you'll need a candle now. You know, we've talked so long, you're going to need a candle. So he hands the Sutra scholar the candle. And when the Sutra scholar takes it, the old master blows out the candle and everything goes black. And then the Sutra scholar has an enlightenment experience, basically. So that's the famous story. So, you know, if you know me pretty well, you know that I think it's really, really super important for Zen practitioners to read the sutras. And I think it's very important to read the sutras and to read, like, reliable scholarship on the sutras. I have often said that the claim that Zen is a transmission outside the sutras is kind of propaganda. Okay. So if you hear people say, I have never read the sutras, I don't need to read them, please try to correct their mistaken view. And if they happen to call themselves Zen teachers, I would recommend you not study with those people. So I think it's really important to read the sutras and to study the sutras. But I think that it's also incredibly important to practice Zen. You know, so reading the sutras is like reading a tour book, like reading a tour guide. So let's say you've never been to China and you've decided to go to Suzhou, which is one of the most beautiful places in China, and it's the home of our ancestral temple, Han Shanshi. But you've never been, and you just decide to go. So you fly in, you don't speak any Chinese, you get a cab, and the cab driver does, you say something in Mandarin, but the cab driver doesn't understand you, and he takes you to the wrong town. And you can't find a place to stay, and you have to sleep on a park bench. And so it would help, right, to have either a tour guide or a guidebook, right? So you would hire a tour guide, and you would go to Suzhou, and you'd see Han Shanshi, and you'd see the beautiful canals and so on. It would help to have a tour book. But it would also be a big mistake, right, just to read the tour book and say, well, I don't need to go to Suzhou. I've already read the tour book, right? So I think this koan isn't really a criticism of people who study the sutras. I think it's talking about how we construct an identity that makes it becomes a trap for us. See, and this is really so essential to who we are as human beings, and it's such a tragedy, right? Because if we're not careful, the older we get, the smaller our world becomes, and it's not our fault. But it happens, see? So, you know, all our lives, first of all, I have my name on my W-2 form. My name is Kurt Spellmeyer, right? And I won't tell you my social security number, not that I don't trust you, but I don't want it on the internet, okay? So it says my name and my social security number. And yet, you know, there was a time in my life when I was not Kurt, right? I mean, when you're a little kid, when you're just growing up, you're not quite Scott or Rumi or Kurt. You're not. You know, you're sort of Kurt, and it's like, you know, you learn early in life that when they call Kurt, you raise your hand, right? Or when your mother calls Kurt, you respond, right? You say, "Oh, she's calling me Kurt. I must be Kurt." But there's no one moment where we suddenly say, "Oh, Kurt is who I really am." You know, it's a gradual process where it's like I have to gradually put on my Kurt suit, you know, and be Kurt. I gradually put on this identity, sort of layer after layer. And this process goes on, and sometimes, you know, we rebel against it. So, you know, if you can remember when you were a teenager, or if you had teenage kids, you know, that's a very unhappy time, I think, for human beings very often. Because you're being asked to put on a certain kind of identity by your parents or by society. And at the same time, your friends are urging you to put on a different identity. And there's all this tension between the identity that society wants you to put on and the identity that your friends want you to put on. And, you know, already at this stage, a lot has been lost, I would say, right? So, you know, I can remember that, you know, when I was young, just to date myself, I was a little kid when the Beatles were starting to become famous. And a lot of my friends in school, in elementary school, actually had like Beatles, the Beatles wore in their original form, the Beatles all wore like these uniforms. They were like harmonized ensembles of clothes that all four of them wore. And they all cut their hair with the bangs cut above their eyebrows. So there was a Beatles haircut, and there were Beatles clothes, and there were even Beatles boots, right? So I remember in my school, all of these kids would get Beatles-style clothes, right? And I wanted, to dress like that. And my parents wouldn't buy me Beatles-style clothes. And I remember just being feeling so aggrieved. It's like, you know, you're not letting me be who I really want to be, right? I really want to go run with the pack and be a Beatle, right? And I remember, I don't have much hair anymore, but I remember combing my hair down over my forehead. And I remember my mother going, "You're not going out of the house like this, right? You know, you've got to put that up, right?" And later in my high school, if you came to high school like some rock stars and you didn't shave, the principal would drag you down to his office and he had an electric razor and he'd make you shave in front of him, right? So I don't know if this is legal anymore, but it was legal when I was going to elementary school and intermediate school and high school. So, you know, this is a struggle, right? Because, you know, society's saying you're going to be this person. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, you look on TV and, you know, the Beatles are arriving from London, and there's like thousands of people screaming. You know, young girls are passing out on the sidewalk with bliss at seeing the Beatles. You kind of think, gee, it would be great if they were cheering for me, you know, or at least I can participate in this, you know. So you can see there's a tension there, right? Society wants you to be a certain kind of person. You want to run with the Beatles pack, right? But, you know, The Beatles pack isn't who you really are either, actually. You know, so as we grow up, you know, we have all these tensions. You know, we are forced to become, I would say, forced to become a self. And that self is constantly, the importance of the self, especially in our society, is constantly reinforced, constantly. And when we try to break out, often it's by becoming a different kind of self, see? So like when I was in college, when I got to college in the early 70s, and about a generation before me, all the guys at college used to wear like khaki pants and Oxford cloth shirt, and when they wanted to dress up, they'd wear like a sports jacket. And my generation got there, and we were sort of like the hippie generation. And you know, if you went into a classroom, I would take classes in French poetry or art history or anthropology. You would walk in, and everybody in the room was a rebel. They all had blue jeans on, right? You know, so. You know, it's like, it's like you're not really all rebels, are you? You know, you're all, if I'm making any sense, you know, everybody's dressing the same way, right? So, you know, the tragedy, I would say, of being a human being is that I think we deeply long to get out of the jail of ourselves, you know? I think there's a part of us that really wants to be free of that. And society has a big stake in not letting us out, right? Not letting us go. It wants us to play that role, and it wants us to like be critical if we don't play it well, right? So you know, society really wants us to be like harsh judge of ourselves, because we're not playing the role it imposed on us to begin with, right? So, you know, I grew up, when I was coming into adulthood, you know, there were a number of women who were writing these wonderful books, like Betty Friedan, for example, and there were a number of other writers. And, that, you know, it was expected that when women got out of school, when they got out of college, they wouldn't pursue a career. They would get married and have children. And they would be basically helpers to their husbands. And you know, lots of women felt really trapped in that role. And they really decided to say no to that. But there was tremendous pressure. I mean, tremendous pressure on them. I remember during the 70s and early 80s, if you identified yourself as a feminist, people would really get mad at you. They would yell. They might even yell at you. Those feminists. You know, those. Oh, even now, you know, and all they're saying is, I don't want to play the role that society has forced upon me. You know, so. So, you know, all our lives, we are performing these roles or fulfilling these roles that our society has expected us to play. But I think that inside of us, there is a, there's something trying to get out. And I think Zen is all about, you know, letting it out, basically, letting that, being free of the self, being free of the self, you know. So we think that maybe freedom will come when we fulfill society's expectations, right? So, you know, basically, in my line of work, you know, if you're in the university, you start out as a graduate student, And you're not free as a graduate student. Everybody bosses you around. And then you become, if you're lucky, you get to be an assistant professor. But you're not free if you're an assistant professor. And then you get to be an associate professor. But you know what? You're still not a professor. And then you become a professor, but you're not a senior professor with a title chair. So actually, you're kind of never good enough. And if you've written 5 books, there's somebody who's written 10, right? So it's like you're always judging yourself it's often the case that we're judging ourselves for not living up to a role we actually didn't choose. We might have thought we chose it, but it's like, you know, we chose from the available roles because people were telling us to choose. And I'm certainly not telling you should quit your job and live in the woods, right? That would not be a good move, right? But what I am saying is that it's very important to realize that you are not your name, you are not your birthday, and actually, your true nature isn't your job. It has no birth and has no death. It has no place of residence. It doesn't have a nationality. See? And it's totally free all the time. But it's hard for us to access that. You know, yesterday in my Taisho, I said, you know, we have like these chains on us, the karmic chains, right? And we carry them around. And one way to think of them is they're all related to identity. They're all related to our struggle to be a worthy self. And ironically, you know, worrying so much about being a worthy self makes us unhelpful to others. It makes us fearful and competitive and ungenerous. I would say, you know, because, you know, if I am worried about being a worthy self, you know, basically in a certain way, there's only so much approval that goes around, right? You know, I mean, if you're a novelist, you know, once in a while a novel will become a bestseller, but, you know, thousands and thousands of novels that are really brilliant books don't become bestsellers. And it's possible, unless you're very careful, to look at your not becoming a bestseller as a defeat and look at the people who do write bestsellers as sort of like your opponents or your competitors. You know, so I would say that once people start down the road of treating their self, the self, as too real, they're going to have an unhappy life. And I think it would be healthier to look at yourself as a kind of like clothing you have to wear on the street. But the more you practice Zen, the more you realize this is not who I really am. And in fact, you know, your true self has no name, it has no nationality, it has no birth and no death. That's Buddhist teaching. And even though, you know, it's like one way to understand Buddhist practice is that, you know, in a certain sense, we know that our identity is kind of like a trap. But because we're afraid of failing at being a self, you know, we're holding on for dear life. It's like we're holding on for dear life, right? So, you know, basically the Zen practice is about saying, look, why don't you just loosen up a little bit? You know, loosen up just a little bit. And you think, but if I loosen up, I could lose everything, right? If I loosen up, I could lose everything. So people do loosen up a little bit and they feel better. You know, around day 3 of Sesshin, you're going to feel better. You're going to breathe the clean, cool air of freedom, you know? But it takes a little while because we've been socialized into being so fearful, of letting go of this thing we call the self. You know, letting go of the self. You know, every once in a while, you let go of the self and you realize this feels great. You know, I'm not trying to achieve anything. I'm not trying to be anyone. I'm not trying to get a degree. I'm not trying to get noticed. You know, I'm just dissolving into the moment. I'm just being 100% present with what is here and now. You know, this is what the Buddha taught. You know, the Buddha, actually Buddhism is really unusual. If you think about it, Buddhism is really unusual. There is no other major world religion that says there is no self. Don't try to have a self. Get free of yourself, you know? If you look at Hinduism says that the thing is to get to the top of a chain of selves. So there's a caste system, and basically the person at the top has the most evolved self, and the person at the bottom has the least evolved self. So that your goal should be to move up through a series of lives until you become the fully realized self. That's Hinduism. With all due respect, you know, Western religions say you have an immortal soul, and, you know, basically that survives death, and, you know, in the next life you will still be cursed, you know. Islam is just like that, right? So you know, Buddhism is really unusual. If you think about it, I can't find another religion that says actually, and that was one of the Buddha's first discoveries. He said, you know, I suffer a lot. Why do I suffer? And he said, I suffer because there's change. But why does change cause me to suffer? And he said, because I believe in a self. And because I cling to a self, I can't change along with things as they change. See? And so that's like the Four Noble Truths. And then he said, you know, there's a way to live. The fourth noble truth is you don't have to live for yourself. You don't have to try to be a self. You can become an empty suit. That's an insult in our culture, but you can become an empty suit. You can inhabit your life, but emptily, right? As not a self. And that the word for somebody who inhabits her life, but not as a self, is bodhisattva. And the word for somebody who fully realizes that no self condition and therefore is 100% compassion is called a Buddha. So, you know, this is day two of Sesshin, and we're just beginning to let go a little bit of the self, the prison of the self, the prison of the self. Now, it doesn't always have to be a prison, but it's a prison when we hold the door closed tightly, right? We're sort of our own jailers. But you know, it's possible to let go a little bit. And every time we give up on the project of being a self, I would say, our lives get a little better. A little better, always, over and over. So, you know, this is really the story of a man who had created a self. He was Diamond Shu, the greatest sutra scholar ever known to humankind. And that was his identity. And, you know, it was hard to give it up, took many years, but when he realized, you know, I don't have to be Diamond Shu. I can just be the sunlight on the ground. I can be the wind blowing in the trees. It's a different, you could say, modality of existence once you're no longer trapped in the illusion of the self. And that's what happens to Diamond Shu. It's not really about clinging to the Diamond Sutra. It's about clinging to identity, see. And we can inhabit our lives emptily, inhabit our lives freely. And when we are no longer fighting to be a self, it's possible to be awake, alert, and generous. So please, everybody here is making a wonderful effort. You know, this morning people were sitting so still, and it was just deeply moving to watch. And some of you have come in later in the day and also sitting very deeply. So thank you so much. Please keep up the good work. Toku-san asked Ryutan about Zen far into the night. At last, Ryutan said, "The night is late, why don't you retire?" Toku-san made bows and lifted the blinds to withdraw, but he was met by darkness. Turning back to Ryutan, he said, "It's dark outside." Ryutan lit a paper candle and handed it to him. Toku-san was about to take it when Ryutan blew it out. See, actually, nirvana means to blow out a candle. What gets blown out in nirvana is the illusion of the self. See, the illusion of the self. He blew it out. Nirvana means blow out. And by the way, samsara, the opposite of nirvana, means to go around in a circle over and over. So you're trapped in your routines. You're trapped in your habitual patterns of identities. And at this, all of a sudden, Toku-san went through a deep experience and made bows. Ryutan said, "What sort of realization do you have?" And Toku-san said, "From now on, you've been talking about getting rid of the self for years, but I understand now. It feels great. I will not doubt the words of an old Osho who is renowned everywhere under the sun." The next day, the old master got up for Taisho, and said, "There's a guy down there, there's a monk over there, who has fangs like a sword tree. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. If you hit him, he's in such deep samadhi, if you hit him with a stick, he won't even look at you." And he says, "Someday or the other, he will climb the highest peaks and establish our way there. He's a free man. He's a free man. He's no longer trapped by the illusion of the self." Mumon's verse, "Hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. He may have lost his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes. He may have kept his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes."